Chapter 5, Part 2. He, however, sent word that the silver images would make admirable substitutes for money, and would be more in character in his possession than in that of the Dominicans themselves, quote, "For," said he, "while you possess them in the manner you do at present, they stand up in niches, useless and motionless, without being of the least benefit to mankind in general, or even to yourselves. But when they come into my possession, they shall be useful. I shall put them in motion, for I intend to have them coined, when they may travel like the apostles, be beneficial in various places, and circulate for the universal service of mankind." End quote. The inquisitors were astonished at this treatment, which they never expected to receive, even from crowned heads. They therefore determined to deliver their precious images in a solemn procession, that they might excite the people to an insurrection. The Dominican friars were accordingly ordered to march to De Legall's house, with the silver apostles and saints, in a mournful manner, having lighted tapers with them and bitterly crying all the way, "Heresy! Heresy!" M. de Legall, hearing these proceedings, ordered four companies of grenadiers to line the street which led to his house. Each grenadier was ordered to have his loaded fusee in one hand and a lighted taper in the other, so that the troops might either repel force with force, or do honor for the farcical solemnity. The friars did all they could to raise the tumult, but the common people were too much afraid of the troops under arms to obey them. The silver images were, therefore, of necessity delivered up to M. de Legall, who sent them to the mint and ordered them to be coined immediately. The project of raising an insurrection having failed, the inquisitors determined to excommunicate M. de Legall, unless he would release their precious silver saints from imprisonment in the mint, before they were melted down, or otherwise mutilated. The French commander absolutely refused to release the images, but said they should certainly travel and do good, upon which the inquisitors drew up the form of excommunication, and ordered their secretary to go and read it to M. de Legall. The secretary punctually performed his commission, and read the excommunication deliberately and distinctly. The French commander heard it with great patience, and politely told the secretary that he would answer it the next day. When the secretary of the Inquisition was gone, M. de Legall ordered his own secretary to prepare a form of excommunication, exactly like that sent by the Inquisition, but to make this alteration, instead of his name, to put in those of the inquisitors. The next morning he ordered four regiments under arms, and commanded them to accompany his secretary and act as he directed. The secretary went to the Inquisition, and insisted upon admittance, which, after a great deal of altercation, was granted. As soon as he entered, he read, in an audible voice, the excommunication sent by M. de Legall against the inquisitors. The inquisitors were all present, and heard it with astonishment, never having before met with any individual who dared to behave so boldly. They loudly cried out against de Legall as a heretic, and said, "This is a most daring insult against the Catholic faith." But to surprise them still more, the French secretary told them that they must remove from their present lodgings, for the French commander wanted to quarter the troops in the Inquisition, as it was the most commodious place in the whole city. The inquisitors exclaimed loudly upon this occasion, when the secretary put them under a strong guard and sent them to a place appointed by M. de Legall to receive them. The inquisitors, finding how things went, begged that they might be permitted to take their private property, which was granted, and they immediately set out for Madrid, where they made the most bitter complaints to the king. But the monarch told them that he could not grant them any redress, as the injuries they had received were from his grandfather, the King of France's troops, by whose assistance alone he could be firmly established in his kingdom. Quote, "Had it been my own troops," said he, "I would have punished them, but as it is, I cannot pretend to exert any authority." End quote. In the meantime, M. de Legall's secretary set open all the doors of the Inquisition, and released the prisoners, who amounted in the whole to 400. And among these were 60 beautiful young women, who appeared to form a seraglio for the three principal inquisitors. This discovery, which laid the enormity of the inquisitors so open, greatly alarmed the archbishop, who desired M. de Legall to send the women to his palace, and he would take proper care of them. And at the same time he published an ecclesiastical censure against all such as should ridicule or blame the holy office of the Inquisition. The French commander sent word to the archbishop that the prisoners had either run away or were so securely concealed by their friends, or even by his own officers, that it was impossible for him to send them back again. And therefore the Inquisition, having committed such atrocious actions, must now put up with their exposure. Some may suggest that it is strange crowned heads and eminent nobles did not attempt to crush the power of the Inquisition and reduce the authority of those ecclesiastical tyrants, from whose merciless fangs neither their families nor themselves were secure. But astonishing as it is, superstition hath, in this case, always overcome common sense, and custom operated against reason. One prince, indeed, intended to abolish the Inquisition, but he lost his life before he became king, and consequently before he had the power so to do, for the very intimation of his design procured his destruction. This was that amiable prince Don Carlos, son of Philip II, king of Spain, and grandson of the celebrated emperor Charles V. Don Carlos possessed all the good qualities of his grandfather, without any of the bad ones of his father, and was a prince of great vivacity, admirable learning, and the most admirable disposition. He had sense enough to see into the errors of popery, and abhorred the very name of the Inquisition. He inveighed publicly against the institution, ridiculed the affected piety of the inquisitors, did all he could to expose their atrocious deeds, and even declared that if he ever came to the crown, he would abolish the Inquisition and exterminate its agents. These things were sufficient to irritate the inquisitors against the prince. They, accordingly, bent their minds to vengeance and determined on his destruction. The inquisitors now employed all their agents and emissaries to spread abroad the most artful insinuations against the prince, and, at length, raised such a spirit of discontent among the people that the king was under the necessity of removing Don Carlos from court. Not content with this, they pursued even his friends, and obliged the king likewise to banish Don John, Duke of Austria, his own brother, and consequently uncle to the prince, together with the Prince of Parma, nephew to the king and cousin to the prince, because they knew that both the Duke of Austria and the Prince of Parma had a most sincere and inviolable attachment to Don Carlos. Some few years after, the prince having shown great lenity and favor to the Protestants in the Netherlands, the Inquisition loudly exclaimed against him, declaring that as the persons in question were heretics, the prince himself must necessarily be one, since he gave them countenance. In short, they gained so great an ascendancy over the mind of the king, who was absolutely a slave to superstition, that, shocking to relate, he sacrificed the feelings of nature to the force of bigotry, and, for fear of incurring the anger of the Inquisition, gave up his only son, passing the sentence of death on him himself. The prince, indeed, had what was termed an indulgence, that is, he was permitted to choose the manner of his death. Roman-like, the unfortunate young hero chose bleeding and the hot bath. When the veins of his arms and legs were opened, he expired gradually, falling a martyr to the malice of the inquisitors and the stupid bigotry of his father. The Persecution of Dr. Egidio. Dr. Egidio was educated at the University of Alcala, where he took his several degrees, and particularly applied himself to the study of the sacred scriptures and school divinity. When the professor of theology died, he was elected into his place and acted so much to the satisfaction of everyone that his reputation for learning and piety was circulated throughout Europe. Egidio, however, had his enemies, and these laid a complaint against him to the inquisitors, who sent him a citation, and when he appeared to it, cast him into a dungeon. As the greatest part of those who belonged to the cathedral church at Seville, and many persons belonging to the bishopric of Dortois highly approved of the doctrines of Egidio, which they thought perfectly consonant with true religion, they petitioned the emperor on his behalf. Though the monarch had been educated a Roman Catholic, he had too much sense to be a bigot, and therefore sent an immediate order for his enlargement. He soon after visited the church of Valladolid, and did everything he could to promote the cause of religion. Returning home, he soon after fell sick and died at an extreme old age. The inquisitors, having been disappointed of gratifying their malice against him while living, determined, as the emperor's whole thoughts were engrossed by a military expedition, to wreak their vengeance on him when dead. Therefore, soon after he was buried, they ordered his remains to be dug out of the grave, and a legal process being carried on, they were condemned to be burnt, which was executed accordingly. The Persecution of Dr. Constantine. Dr. Constantine, an intimate acquaintance of the already mentioned Dr. Egidio, was a man of uncommon natural abilities and profound learning. Exclusive of several modern tongues, he was acquainted with the Latin, Greek, and Hebrew languages, and perfectly well knew not only the sciences called abstruse, but those arts which came under the denomination of polite literature. His eloquence rendered him pleasing, and the soundness of his doctrines a profitable teacher. And he was so popular that he never preached but to a crowded audience. He had many opportunities of rising in the church, but never would take advantage of them, for if a living of greater value than his own was offered him, he would refuse it, saying, "I am content with what I have." And he frequently preached so forcibly against simony that many of his superiors, who were not so delicate upon the subject, took umbrage at his doctrines upon that head. Having been fully confirmed in Protestantism by Dr. Aegidio, he preached boldly such doctrines only as were agreeable to gospel purity and uncontaminated by the errors which had at various times crept into the Romish Church. For these reasons he had many enemies among the Roman Catholics, and some of them were fully determined on his destruction. A worthy gentleman named Scobaria, having erected a school for divinity lectures, appointed Dr. Constantine to be reader therein. He immediately undertook the task, and read lectures, by portions, on the Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Canticles, and was beginning to expound the book of Job when he was seized by the inquisitors. Being brought to examination, he answered with such precaution that they could not find any explicit charge against him, but remained doubtful in what manner to proceed, when the following circumstances occurred to determine them. Dr. Constantine had deposited with a woman named Isabella Martin several books, which to him were very valuable, but which he knew, in the eyes of the Inquisition, were exceptionable. This woman, having been informed against as a Protestant, was apprehended, and, after a small process, her goods were ordered to be confiscated. Previous, however, to the officers coming to her house, the woman's son had removed away several chests full of the most valuable articles. Among these were Dr. Constantine's books. A treacherous servant gave intelligence of this to the inquisitors, and an officer was dispatched to the son to demand the chests. The son, supposing the officer only came for Constantine's books, said, "I know what you came for, and I will fetch them to you immediately." He then fetched Dr. Constantine's books and papers, when the officer was greatly surprised to find that which he did not look for. He, however, told the young man that he was glad these books and papers were produced, but nevertheless he must fulfill the end of his commission, which was to carry him and the goods he had embezzled before the inquisitors, which he did accordingly. For the young man knew it would be in vain to expostulate or resist, and therefore quietly submitted to his fate. The inquisitors, being thus possessed of Constantine's books and writings, now found matter sufficient to form charges against him. When he was brought to a re-examination, they presented one of his papers, and asked him if he knew the handwriting. Perceiving it was his own, he guessed the whole matter, confessed the writing, and justified the doctrine it contained, saying, quote, "In that, and all my other writings, I have never departed from the truth of the gospel, but have always kept in view the pure precepts of Christ as he delivered them to mankind," unquote. After being detained upwards of 2 years in prison, Dr. Constantine was seized with a bloody flux, which put an end to his miseries in this world. The process, however, was carried on against his body, which, at the ensuing auto la fe, was publicly burnt. The Life of William Gardiner. William Gardiner was born at Bristol, received a tolerable education, and was, at a proper age, placed under the care of a merchant named Paget. At the age of 26 years, he was, by his master, sent to Lisbon to act as factor. Here he applied himself to the study of the Portuguese language, executed his business with assiduity and dispatch, and behaved with the most engaging affability to all persons with whom he had the least concern. He conversed privately with a few whom he knew to be zealous Protestants, and, at the same time, cautiously avoided giving the least offense to any who were Roman Catholics. He had not, however, hitherto gone into any of the popish churches. A marriage being concluded between the King of Portugal's son and the Infanta of Spain, upon the wedding day the bridegroom, bride, and the whole court went to the cathedral church, attended by multitudes of all ranks of people, and among the rest William Gardiner, who stayed during the whole ceremony and was greatly shocked at the superstitions he saw. The erroneous worship which he had seen ran strongly in his mind. He was miserable to see a whole country sunk into such idolatry, when the truth of the gospel might be so easily obtained. He, therefore, took the inconsiderate, though laudable design, into his head, of making a reform in Portugal, or perishing in the attempt, and determined to sacrifice his prudence to his zeal, though he became a martyr upon the occasion. To this end he settled all his worldly affairs, paid his debts, closed his books, and consigned over his merchandise. On the ensuing Sunday he went again to the cathedral church, with a New Testament in his hand, and placed himself near the altar. The king and the court soon appeared, and a cardinal began Mass, at that part of the ceremony in which the people adore the wafer. Gardiner could hold out no longer, but springing towards the cardinal, he snatched the host from him and trampled it under his feet. This action amazed the whole congregation, and one person, drawing a dagger, wounded Gardiner in the shoulder, and would, by repeating the blow, have finished him, had not the king called to him to desist. Gardiner, being carried before the king, the monarch asked him what countryman he was, to which he replied, "I am an Englishman by birth, a Protestant by religion, and a merchant by occupation. What I have done is not out of contempt to your royal person, God forbid it should, but out of an honest indignation to see the ridiculous superstitious and gross idolatries practiced here." The king, thinking that he had been stimulated by some other person to act as he had done, demanded who was his abettor, to which he replied, "My own conscience alone. I would not hazard what I have done for any man living, but I owe that and all other services to God." Gardiner was sent to prison, and a general order issued to apprehend all Englishmen in Lisbon. This order was in a great measure put into execution, some few escaping, and many innocent persons were tortured to make them confess if they knew anything of the matter. In particular, a person who resided in the same house with Gardiner was treated with unparalleled barbarity to make him confess something which might throw a light upon the affair. Gardiner himself was then tormented in the most excruciating manner, but in the midst of all his torments he gloried in the deed. Being ordered for death, a large fire was kindled near a gibbet. Gardiner was drawn up to the gibbet by pulleys, and then let down near the fire, but not so close as to touch it, for they burnt or rather roasted him by slow degrees. Yet he bore his sufferings patiently, and resigned his soul to the Lord cheerfully. It is observable that some of the sparks that were blown from the fire, which consumed Gardiner, towards the haven, burnt one of the king's ships of war, and did other considerable damage. The Englishmen who were taken up on this occasion were, soon after Gardiner's death, all discharged, except the person who resided in the same house with him, who was detained 2 years before he could procure his liberty. An account of the life and sufferings of Mr. William Lithgow, a native of Scotland. This gentleman was descended from a good family, and having a natural propensity for traveling, he rambled, when very young, over the northern and western islands, after which he visited France, Germany, Switzerland, and Spain. He set out on his travels in the month of March, 1609, and the first place he went to was Paris, where he stayed for some time. He then prosecuted his travels through Germany and other parts, and at length arrived at Malaga, in Spain, the seat of all his misfortunes. During his residence here, he contracted with the master of a French ship for his passage to Alexandria, but was prevented from going by the following circumstances. In the evening of the 17th of October, 1620, the English fleet, at that time on a cruise against the Algerine rovers, came to anchor before Malaga, which threw the people of the town into the greatest consternation, as they imagined them to be Turks. The morning, however, discovered the mistake, and the governor of Malaga, perceiving the cross of England in their colors, went on board Sir Robert Mansell's ship, who commanded on that expedition, and after staying some time returned and silenced the fears of the people. The next day many persons from on board the fleet came ashore. Among these were several well known by Mr. Lithgow, who, after reciprocal compliments, spent some days together in festivity and the amusements of the town. They then invited Mr. Lithgow to go on board and pay his respects to the admiral. He accordingly accepted the invitation, was kindly received by him, and detained till the next day, when the fleet sailed. The admiral would willingly have taken Mr. Lithgow with him to Algiers, but having contracted for his passage to Alexandria, and his baggage, etc., being in the town, he could not accept the offer. As soon as Mr. Lithgow got on shore, he proceeded towards his lodgings by a private way, being to embark the same night for Alexandria, when, in passing through a narrow uninhabited street, he found himself suddenly surrounded by 9 sergeants, or officers, who threw a black cloak over him, and forcibly conducted him to the governor's house. After some little time the governor appeared, when Mr. Lithgow earnestly begged he might be informed of the cause of such violent treatment. The governor only answered by shaking his head, and gave orders that the prisoner should be strictly watched until he, the governor, returned from his devotions, directing at the same time that the captain of the town, the alcalde major, and the town notary should be summoned to appear at his examination, and that all this should be done with the greatest secrecy, to prevent the knowledge reaching the ears of the English merchants then residing in the town. These orders were strictly discharged, and on the governor's return, he, with the officers, having seated themselves, Mr. Lithgow was brought before them for examination. The governor began by asking several questions, namely, of what country he was, whither bound, and how long he had been in Spain. The prisoner, after answering these and other questions, was conducted to a closet, where, in a short space of time, he was visited by the town captain, who inquired whether he had ever been at Seville, or was lately come from thence, and patting his cheeks with an air of friendship, conjured him to tell the truth, quote, "For," said he, "your very countenance shows there is some hidden matter in your mind, which prudence should direct you to disclose," end quote. Finding himself, however, unable to extort anything from the prisoner, he left him and reported the same to the governor and the other officers, on which Mr. Lithgow was again brought before them, a general accusation was laid against him, and he was compelled to swear that he would give true answers to such questions as should be asked him. The governor proceeded to inquire the quality of the English commander, and the prisoner's opinion what were the motives that prevented his accepting an invitation from him to come on shore. He demanded, likewise, the names of the English captains in the squadron, and what knowledge he had of the embarkation, or preparation for it, before his departure from England. The answers given to the several questions asked were set down in writing by the notary, but the junto seemed surprised at his denying any knowledge of the fitting out of the fleet, particularly the governor, who said he lied, that he was a traitor and a spy, and came directly from England to favor and assist the designs that were projected against Spain, and that he had been for that purpose 9 months in Seville, in order to procure intelligence of the time the Spanish navy was expected from the Indies. They exclaimed against his familiarity with the officers of the fleet, and many other English gentlemen, between whom, they said, unusual civilities had passed, but all these transactions had been carefully noticed. Besides, to sum up the whole, and put the truth past all doubt, they said he came from a council of war, held that morning on board the admiral's ship, in order to put in execution the orders assigned him. They upbraided him with being accessory to the burning of the island of St. Thomas, in the West Indies. Quote, "Wherefore," said they, "these Lutherans and sons of the devil ought to have no credit given to what they say or swear." End quote. In vain did Mr. Lithgow endeavor to obviate every accusation laid against him, and to obtain belief from his prejudiced judges. He begged permission to send for his cloak-bag, which contained his papers, and might serve to show his innocence. This request they complied with, thinking it would discover some things of which they were ignorant. The cloak-bag was accordingly brought, and being opened, among other things was found a license from King James I, under the sign manual, setting forth the bearer's intention to travel into Egypt, which was treated by the haughty Spaniards with great contempt. The other papers consisted of passports, testimonials, etc., of persons of quality. All these credentials, however, seemed rather to confirm than abate the suspicions of these prejudiced judges, who, after seizing all the prisoner's papers, ordered him again to withdraw. In the meantime, a consultation was held to fix the place where the prisoner should be confined. The alcalde, or chief judge, was for putting him into the town prison, But this was objected to, particularly by the corregidor, who said in Spanish, quote, "In order to prevent the knowledge of his confinement from reaching his countrymen, I will take the matter on myself, and be answerable for the consequences," end quote, upon which it was agreed that he should be confined in the governor's house with the greatest secrecy.